Welcome to Computer Science E259. My name is David Malin, and this is Lecture 8, XQuery and DTD. But as we often do, it's useful to take a look back before we take a look forward. Last week, recall, we introduced a whole bunch of things, all of which you've probably had fun experimenting with. In fact, how is Wahoo coming along? Oh. Always get some cute looks when we ask questions like this. Okay. Realize that, as I mentioned at the end of lecture last week, you pretty much have everything under your belt that you absolutely need in order to do that project to completion. Tonight, we will spend time on DTD, but really, Project 3's mention of DTD is incidental. We mentioned it in one of the problems as to how the data is structured. That question should, after tonight, make more sense, if not already. But beyond that, you should have all of the building blocks from last week's examples and from the project spec itself as to how to pull that one off. And try to leave particular room for the last part of the project, which is to personalize it somehow, because I think that's where you'll have the most fun. Notice also that per my email, we posted a few sample solutions to Project 1 on the course's website that were consented to by some of your fellow classmates who did particularly nice jobs with their implementation, so feel free to browse those. Last week, though, we looked at a few things. We started off with HTTP, one of the most salient features of which was this cookie mechanism. In a sentence, what is a cookie? Good. So it's a text file that gets written to your local disk by your browser, placed there by some web server. What's typically in such a file? Identifies the user. So what do you mean by that? What's in the file? So it's binary information. Be more specific. How do you identify a user? Yeah, so some kind of unique ID, some sort of pseudo-random number that was spit out by the server, tucked away on the client. What does that imply that the server is doing with that number after sending it back to you as a cookie? It's got to save it. It's got to record it in its own memory so that the next time your browser queries that website, the browser, if it adheres to the HTTP spec correctly, will send along with your HTTP request that same cookie. And these cookies are identified by way of the domains or subdomains that put them on the user's browser in the first place. You could put more in a cookie, certainly. You could push more information client-side, but typically all of this so-called session information is stored server-side, since it gives you rather arbitrary storage, and you can get rid of it when you want. And it simply makes things easier, generally. You, though, for Project 3, even if you've dived quite deeply into it, probably haven't so much as had to touch cookies yourself. There was no writing of code on your part for cookies, so how are these cookies even relevant to Project 3? The user information? How do you mean? Okay, when you log in, it's pushing session information. Again, what do you mean? So you log in. So when you log in to Wahoo, what's happening as it relates to cookies?
So getting his preferences set in his profile, like getting that user information.
So the server is getting user information by way of our users.xml file, and this was the so-called user, what we call it, user database mechanism, as depicted in the Wahoo architecture. But again, you haven't convinced me that cookies are relevant here. How are cookies relevant?
I don't think cookies are relevant to Wahoo.
Ah.
If you're starting a session and you lose the information, if the browser closes, you don't have that information anymore, and the session information is only good for that instance of the browser.
Okay, true. So the moment you close your browser window, you effectively lose or destroy that session. But that's not because there was no cookie in place. Though we initially defined it tonight as a small file that can be placed on your computer, they can also be placed elsewhere, we said last week. Right? If you have a transient, a quote-unquote session-based cookie that persists only for the lifetime of that browser window, well, there is a cookie being sent back and forth, but it's maintained entirely in the client's RAM. or primary memory. It's not pushed off the disk, which is where it would be pushed for a persistent cookie, where you could specify that this cookie should last not for the session scope, but rather for 24 hours or 100 hours or 2 weeks or whatnot. This, after all, is how a site like CNN.com remembers upon subsequent visits that you like the U.S. edition as opposed to the international edition. Right? Those are not session-based cookies, because when you close the window and launch CNN.com the next day, hopefully, if you're letting cookies through in the first place, it will still remember what your previous preferences are. So Wahoo is very much using cookies, but there's no mention of cookies in any of the distribution code. So how are they, in fact, involved? Where are they involved in that architecture?
Setting the session parameters.
Setting the session parameters? What do you mean? So it's in the login process. The login code, though, that we wrote contains no mention of cookies. Even when the code traverses the user manager code, again, we make no mention of cookies per se. So yes, there's definitely cookie information going back and forth in the sessions. And really, the point I'm trying to make here is that the reason that we haven't put our fingers on where it is within the Wahoo architecture is because it's a feature that you get with something like a J2EE architecture, or really a lot of application server environments in general. This is one of the things Tomcat's doing for you. Tomcat has the ability, by way of this session object in the first place, to associate server-side memory with a particular user. The means by which it's usually doing that is, unbeknownst to you and completely underneath the hood, passing these cookies back and forth. But that's the beauty of running on top of an environment that you yourself just have to launch. You don't need to write code like set cookie or get cookie. All of that is created for you through a layer of abstraction that we describe as the session object, or the session. Yeah?
Can we say that the session class is invoked by the servlet container?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the servlet container, or more generally the application server, that is providing you, the developer, with this abstraction that we call the servlet object, or instances of the servlet class, but it's the server that's actually maintaining a chunk of memory called the session object for each user that visits an instance of this web application. And again, that's one of the upsides, because as one who approaches the application as a developer and not so much a sysadmin or someone who would otherwise manage the web server, a lot of these things you get for free. And that's the nice thing about pulling off the shelf these kinds of components these days, because you get so many features for free, so to speak. So we looked at what might be described as a general instance of an N-tier enterprise application, and this is just big word speak for describing an architecture in which you try to segment things out. You might have your database as a separate module. You might have your presentation layer as a separate conceptual entity. You might have the back-end or business logic type section where you might put all of the servlet code, but it might be the JSPs that stand closer to the user conceptually with presentation layer. Again, you can slap all sorts of jargon around these things, but in short, it was all about compartmentalization, as we discussed last week and as we've tried to model with Wahoo. We looked specifically at two aspects of J2EE, which you have begun to incorporate into your own code. JSPs, which we'll touch upon just briefly in Project 3, but more to the point, Java servlets. So a servlet, in another sentence or so, what is it? It's okay. I'll just assume that I taught it very poorly last week. Yeah.
It's a web application.
Okay, web application. Great. So in so many languages these days, you have the equivalent of what's being provided by servlets, right? In Perl, you can create CGIs. In C and C++, you can do CGI. You can do PHP, which similarly creates this application environment specific to that language. Servlets and JSPs are, in a sense, sort of Java's answer to web-based applications. You can implement things in other ways, and there are other aspects of J2EE that we don't even touch upon in this course. But in short, they are a means by which you can implement web-based applications. Are they only instances of the HTTP servlet abstract class? To the extent that I'm familiar with them, yes. It's possible that there exist other variants in the J2EE spec, or at least the code base might be designed in a way that allows you to abstract away the particular transport mechanism being used. But I would have to myself look through the specification for a better answer. A good question. All right, so with that said, we launch into tonight, and this was just a reminder of where we came from last week and Wahoo. And actually, let me pause here before we charge ahead. If there are any questions architecturally or code-wise with Wahoo as it's been presented, because tonight's section will really just be casual Q&A since we pretty much introduced it all last week, if quickly. Yeah? What is the difference between a servlet container and a servlet engine? As I would use the terms, none really. But I'm going to hedge slightly lest I be caught on a technicality. But I use them rather interchangeably. Same thing for application server for our purposes. Question? Hmm? A servlet is designed to be executed within the confines of a servlet container, right? It would be like trying to run a CGI program, but just at the command prompt without a web server to actually execute it for you. Would be a bit of an analogy. Yeah?
What's the mechanism that causes boot work in any one of these servlets? What causes boot work?
It's a good question. So what invokes do work? Well, recall that do work was a method that we implemented in the Wahoo servlet abstract class. And this was simply a little trick that we used in order to funnel both get requests and post requests to the same code. So it's actually do get and do post that themselves are called automatically by the servlet container when a servlet is invoked. And I think that I sent along to the webs, to the list. Whenever, well, what? Let me answer by way of a stack trace, which I think I also, for reference, posted over to the listserv a few days ago. If we spawn Tomcat in Project 3's directory, actually, first what I'm going to do is go into the source base, and I'm going to go into login.java, which is the servlet, recall, that is first invoked when you visit it. Just for kicks, what I'm going to do is the very first line of the do work method is insert a new exception call. A new exception, and then I'm going to call print stack trace so that essentially the moment the login servlet is invoked and this do work method is somehow invoked, what we'll see on our console is precisely the steps by which we got there. And a lot of it is going to be sort of overwhelming because a lot of it is germane only to the inner workings of the servlet container, but we will see in the last few stack frames what's interesting about it. So I'm going to recompile that servlet with ant. And I'm next going, what did I do? Oh, constructor. Recompile with ant. And let's go ahead now and run Tomcat. I pre-configured server.xml to use port, my favorite, 8080. Thus far, we've not had any collisions, which is good. I am on ICE 5 this time, so I'm going to go to http://ice5fas.harvard.edu, port 8080, and in a moment I'm going to hit enter. Notice here's my console, so we're in a moment going to see the stack trace on the console. The moment that I hit enter, because I'm redirected to that Wahoo servlet. So what has happened here, and it's a little sloppy because of all of the font size, but notice that do work is the most recently called method. Prior to that was the Wahoo servlet's do get method. So by default, when you visit a page and you haven't posted with like a submit button, you're sending a get request, as we introduced last week. What's invoking the Wahoo servlet's do get method is a method called service, which is in the HTTP servlet class, which we recall extended. So Wahoo servlet is an extension of a class called HTTP servlet, which is pretty much the base from which you derive additional servlets that you yourself write. And what you're getting in the implementation of the servlet specification by Tomcat is all of this stuff. So most of this is irrelevant to anyone other than a container developer, but it's that service method that by default is invoking your do get or do post method, which you have overridden, which we have overridden in Wahoo servlet to call do work. So in short, when you, say, subsequent to this class, sit down to write your own servlet, most likely what you're going to do is write something like our Wahoo servlet.java. You're going to write a class, doesn't need to be abstract, that extends HTTP servlet, and it's up to you then to implement either or both of do get and do post, taking care to use the same signatures that the Java doc tells you to. So that's all. Good question. And if you want to take a look at that stack trace again, you can certainly code it yourself or look back at one of the listserv posts that I think we had. Other Wahoo questions? No? And if you didn't notice already, what I've been doing often after sections is from past semesters, there have been teaching fellows who have put together sometimes helpful resources and so forth. So do realize that some of that is linked on the sections page of the website, even though we don't talk about it necessarily here. So one of the oft-asked questions for Wahoo has always been, what do you mean? What should this look like? And so what a past teaching fellow did was put a screenshot on that we've included on the sections page that should help you visualize this. But you are welcome to alter that same vision and implement it as you see fit.
I've forgotten. What do servlets have to do with XML?
Good question. What do servlets have to do with XML? Fundamentally, nothing. There is no requirement that you in any way involve XML with servlets beyond perhaps what tends to be convention in the implementation of these servlet containers, which is to implement them if with no other XML than the configuration files. But that is sort of a meaningless detail or meaningless use of XML. We are using it as a means of providing a server-based architecture, and on top of that, we're experimenting with these various XML technologies. That's a good thing to keep clear. You don't need to know open tag, close tag to use servlets. Okay, other questions? All right, so forging ahead. This is perhaps the one lecture where we go out on a bit of a limb when it comes to talking about a topic that hasn't yet been finalized. That is in part because you've already experienced for yourselves, hopefully, some of the limitations of XPath and XSLT. And I say hopefully for pedagogical reasons, not for implementation reasons. You've probably found them to be frustrating at times. How many of you, out of curiosity, have made use of extension functions, XSLT extension functions? So realize, too, I mean, this is sometimes the best way to work around glaring deficiencies in features is to use these so-called extension functions. And you're welcome to use any of those, as I've said, that are implemented by Xalin, since that is sort of our de facto choice for an XSLT processor. Other engines, relatively few as there might be that boast the same popularity, might have their own extensions as well. Saxon and Stylus and XMLSpy, they all, I believe, the latter two, do ship with their own XSLT processors. XQuery, though, is, I would say, a combination of a programming language, a scripting language unto itself, and something more reminiscent of a SQL-type query language. XPath is relatively limited in what you can do, and coupling XPath with XSLT does let you do additional things, but not quite as straightforwardly as you might like, and not necessarily in a, dare say, one-line environment whereby if you're trying to interact with a database, you might like to query an XML-specific database for a collection of nodes. It's hard to imagine querying a database, at least efficiently, using an XSLT style sheet. That's not really where the language is meant to be used. So recall that XPath does allow you to apply a bit of logic, right? There's a few XPath functions, right? Round and substring and those sorts of things. But if you really want to do powerful manipulation of data retrieved from an XML document, you've got to whip out, thus far, XSLT. But again, then you're implementing a whole style sheet, and that sort of is quite the departure from a world in which, in, say, a SQL world, you can, between double quotes, write a database selection that returns to you nodes in some rows, rather, from a table in some sort of order, or objects from a table in some sort of order. So XQuery is a step toward reconciling, perhaps, that sort of conceptual lacking that exists right now, but it is only in candidate recommendation status, which is so close to being finished. But it's been now 3 or 4 years since I've been involved with this course, and you know, every year we sort of figure, all right, this will be the year where it finally goes to recommendation status, but it's been in rather a holding pattern, jumping around in the W3C stack for quite some time. But with that said, there are several implementations. Stylus does offer an XQuery processor. I believe XMLSpy does as well. Saxon by Michael Kay, who is one of the one of the best, most well-known individuals involved in the development of the XSLT and XPath and XQuery specifications. He has this, he's the red book that you might be using for XSLT. In short, Saxon supports the latest candidate recommendation for XQuery. I'm not sure which specs Stylus and XMLSpy currently support. I would suspect it's the current one as well, though in some experimentation I found differences between how Saxon was behaving and Stylus was behaving, so that's not surprising. But we introduce XQuery so that even if things change slightly over the next few months or the next year or so, you at least have some of the basic building blocks, or at least a familiarity with some of the features of this language. And I think the best introduction to it is perhaps by way of some examples, which rather speak for themselves and convey not only the syntax, but some of the new ideas that are conveyed in XQuery. Yeah?
The printed slide says it's a working draft, but the one up there says it's a candidate
recommendation. Indeed. That was me working some magic before class by fixing the PDF. So the online PDF has been updated, and there's a few other minor tweaks, but thanks for noting this one. What you see before you is correct. The printouts are a week outdated. I missed that during the first revision of them. So inherently related to XQuery 1 is XPath 2. XPath 2 and XSLT 2 are similarly up and coming, and there's a lot of borrowing, as we've already seen with these various recommendations. And so you'll see XPath 2 syntax being used in XQuery statements themselves, the latter of which XQuery is rather a superset of XPath 2.0. So with that said, a few examples, and you can play with these online if you choose, not with Xalen, because Xalen only supports XSLT 1 and XPath 1, and not these newer features, but if you do want to use Saxon, it is installed on NICE, and I can help you figure out how to use it, or Stylus, and probably XMLSpy have their own little XQuery environments to dabble with, if you would like. But path expressions. One of the basic building blocks of XQuery 1 is this notion of a path expression, pretty much borrowed from XPath 1. You see the notion of being able to access a specific document with the doc function, and then using a location path to simply get at the data you want. Just for review, the last line here in English is requesting what nodes from where. All the book elements whose price is less than 50, and those book elements, of course, are children of bib, which is presumably the root element of a document called books.xml. So pretty straightforward. A lot of this, even though the syntax will be slightly new in a moment, is nicely readable, which is a nice feature in and of itself. What you'll notice, though, is that we are departing in XQuery even more so from what would be otherwise thought of as rigorous XML syntax. You will soon see that there is a huge intermingling in just a moment between what would be sort of loose syntax and inserting as much white space as you want and curly braces and so forth, and intermingling of what's a scripting language really with XML syntax. But one of the basic building blocks of XQuery is to be these so-called flower expressions, which stands for for, let, where, order, return, expression. So sort of a cute acronym, if a little contrived. And the basic definition of them is this sort of regular expression like definition. Essentially, a flower expression is one that can include a for clause or a let clause, and any number of those, one or more, followed by a where clause, followed by an ordering clause, followed by a return statement and an expression. So even though this is a little more verbose than a SQL query, it's sort of similar in spirit, for those of you familiar, right? The notion of having a where and an order by, very much borrowed from, say, the domain of SQL. Here's an example. So if you wanted to execute an XQuery expression against an XML document called books.xml, this would be a valid XQuery. And this is excerpted from, in fact, one of the online tutorials that we have linked for your review. I'll defer to you. I mean, what is this going to select from a document called books.xml? I would say not quite. So the suggestion was all the books whose price is greater than 50. It selects what? So, there we go. So recall that you sort of have to think about it in reverse order, right? Because the flower definition ends with the return of some expression. Well, what is literally being returned? Well, clearly it's some kind of title. So the implication there is what you're going to get back is a node set of title elements, each of which is the child of some placeholder X. Well, what are the constraints on X? X is going to be what type of element, first of all? A book, right? You can sort of read this like you could most scripting languages. So X is being assigned iteratively to all of the book elements in the document, whereby those book elements themselves are children of the root element called bib. But on each iteration of this loop, there's some consideration of what kind of book you're looking at. You only want to include this book element in consideration if its price, child, is greater than 50. Then do you want to include this current book's title element in your resulting node set. But you want to order that node set such that they're sorted by, of course, title. So notice here, it's sort of an intermingling of an XPath expression, but with some of the capabilities of XSLT, but in a way that it's not, say, as straightforward to implement this same notion with, say, XSLT1, if you wanted to return such a node set with a template, for instance. All right, how about something a little more interesting? So this is excerpted from the XQuery recommendation itself in some prior form. This is just a chunk of XML, a bib element, and you'll actually see this example laced certainly in the XQuery recommendation, but also I think Stylus, among its examples, have borrowed some of the syntax as well as time has passed. So here is a collection of free books, and on the subsequent slide, all of which you have printouts of, here is another instance of what you might be able to do with XQuery 1. So you have the ability in XQuery, again, to really intermingle what looks like XML with what looks like some kind of query or scripting language. So what you're going to return here is a node called authList, an element called authList. What will be the children of this element, as you can infer from this example, it's alone. So it's going to be author elements, because notice what's being returned. Well, what's being returned this time is an author element, but a child of that author element is going to be a name element. What is going to be the text node child of that thing? Well, you sort of have the equivalent of like one of the, sort of a counterpart to attribute value templates. So when the squiggly braces here, we're evaluating $a/text. So that's the text value of what node? Well, what is A on each iteration? It's going to be, in effect, the name of the author, but looking back, well, what is an author? An author is an element that has one child, which is a text node, like Stevens, for instance. So what that return statement's going to do is going to return an author element with a name child whose name is that author, but also it's going to have a books child, and inside of that books child is going to be what? Exactly. So a node set of zero or more title elements that were written by that author. Yeah?
Are the braces necessary because they seem to be correlated with the
elements? I believe at the time of writing they were necessary. So unless something's changed, and I don't believe it has, they would be, in fact, necessary when you want to enclose some sort of logical structure. Because though we've been nicely indenting things here for human readability, really the only constraint that groups those lines of code together is the presence of those squiggly braces.
Is it double slash?
Ah, good question. What is the meaning of this double slash? So we have the double slash up top first. First of all, we can borrow, this is the same syntax from XPath 1. Slash slash is shorthand for the descendant or self axis, which is sort of the lazy man's way of saying, go find me author elements anywhere at or beneath this current element. So it's going to find author elements at any point below the books variable, which we assume was initialized earlier in some let clause to be the file from the previous slide. And same thing down here. It's saying find any book elements that are inside of this, as descendants of this books element, whatever it happens to be pointing to. And some of these examples you'll see in greater context if you look at the actual recommendation itself, because again, I've tried to draw them from the recommendations themselves, since that's the most authoritative source, certainly, for the current design. Here's another fragment of XML, but this is precisely what would have been generated. Let me come back in just 1 second. So notice that we have one main element, one root element that's been returned, an auth list. It's a little small, but just to fit everything on the screen here, we have four different author elements, each of which was generated by the foregoing code, because recall that the previous page's code did have this return statement, but recall that that return statement is in effect in the scope of that for loop. So even though, and this is sort of dissimilar to a lot of languages, here we're saying return this, but the return is in effect nested inside of a for construct, the for construct starting at line 3 up there. Right? XML generally has been all about returning node sets or managing node sets or manipulating node sets. So the means by which you can return a node set is to do something like this in XQuery, whereby the implication is not that you're returning one and only one author element. For each iteration, return one of these. The implication is that they're all going to be lumped together in a node set that's ultimately returned. John, and then next one. Okay, because at this point, the dollar sign A is referring to an author element, and an author element from our XML fragment simply contains one child, the text node. And the reason, incidentally, for the resulting node set, the auth list having four authors, is notice how many authors were, in fact, in this original file. Four unique individuals. Stevens wrote two of these books. And notice that one of the calls, though we didn't make explicit mention of it, is this function, which comes with XPath 2.0. It's called distinct values, which, as the name suggests, selects the nodes with distinct values. So that, too, comes with XPath 2.0. Another question? This? Books in this context is a variable, and I wave my hand at this detail as the recommendation does. Books is assumed to point to most likely the root of this document. So prior to this code was something like a let $books equals doc of quote unquote bib.xml or whatever the file is called. When you look at it in the context of the recommendation, you'll see that books, I think, is defined earlier in the document from which this part was excerpted. But it's the equivalent of, for instance, back here, doing something like doc of books.xml. Store that in a variable called $books. So it's a variable in this context, not an element called books. Yeah?
What if you wanted to return the title element, but you wanted to name it something else?
So what you could do is something very similar to what we're... So the question is, what if you wanted to return the title element but call it something else, like book name? Well, you could do something very similar to what we're doing with the author's name element here. We could change the author's name, for instance, to anything we want. We could say author name, but then output with the XQuery the value of that original author element's node. Title, right, you would do something like $t, where t is a title, slash text to grab its value. So same idea with XSLT. You could use XSL element to output a new node altogether, and then just use the value of to get some prior node's value, just to effectively rename the node. Yeah?
In where it says $a/text, is there an implicit return there, or is that a different kind of...
No, so where it says $a/text, is there an implicit return there? No, what's being returned is a collection of author elements, since that explicitly is what immediately follows the return expression. Everything nested beneath that is going to be a children of the current author node that's in effect being constructed. And so what this is, and again, in a sense of like an attribute value template in XSLT 1.0, it's substituting what's between the squiggly braces for what the resulting value is. So it's like pasting that value there.
Oh, okay. I was comparing it with what's inside the books, but I guess what's inside the books element there is a flower expression, and what's inside the name element isn't?
Correct. So what you have in the latter case is a full-fledged flower expression.
Okay.
Yes. Whereas the other one is simply a value of construct. Yeah. So could you, can you rephrase? I'm not sure I follow.
Right now we're getting authors as a unique key.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, can you get like author and title together and just figure out author and then title?
So sure, we could certainly iterate over this file in a different way. For instance, iterating over the book elements and simply outputting the author and its his or her respective title. So in short, yes, and I would say a useful rule of thumb is certainly anything you could do with XSLT1 you could do in this environment, albeit with a different syntax. And what the problem you just described would not be a hard problem, generally, just be a different sort of iteration. One other example that's perhaps a bit more intense in terms of its use of a flower expression, because this one uses a let, for instance, would be something like this. This, too, is excerpted from the recommendation itself. So let's read this top to bottom. So the first line is a for construct. So for some variable D in the document called departments.xml/department number. So what this is saying is grab all of the department number elements from this document and iterate over them on each pass calling the current element $D. Meanwhile, let for each iteration the variable E equal the employee element who works in that department. Or rather, let E be equal a node set of employees that work in that department. And again, I'm trying to translate this quite literally into English, but if we want to be more technical about it, well, doc of emps.xml is obviously grabbing the root element of that document, /emp is grabbing via descendant or self all of the EMP elements, which are presumed to be employee elements. Then we have this predicate, like we did in XPath 1.0, that's saying only choose those EMP elements whose department number child equals the current value of $D. So what you have already in XQuery 1.0 is this ability to mutate variables and on each iteration reassign a variable. It's not a functional programming language like XSLT was. Notice, though, that we have a where clause here, which is saying, but only do so if the count of employees is greater than 10. So in effect, only select big departments is the sort of literal English translation. Meanwhile, go ahead and order this node set by the average salary in descending order, and go ahead and output the following. Go ahead and output a big department element inside of which is a child called D. Well, what's D? Department. So we're really doing a literal substitution. D currently points to a DEPTNO element. So that's what's going to get pasted right there. As a second child of the big department element will be what? The number of people in that department by way of this headcount element and this sort of attribute value template-like construct here, count being a function, counting the number of employees in the node set. Average salary, meanwhile, is going to be a computation of the average function applied to all of the salary elements of those employees. And that's it. So in short, on a high-level English description, what you have is an XQuery query that's going to return a node set of big departments ordered by way of average salary. So it's going to return to you only big departments, and by big I mean departments with more than 10 or more people, and it's going to order that node set of big departments by way of which department earns the most. So in short, what you get is a top N list of the departments in some company that you might want to work for. The first node being the one you probably really want to work for because that department's employees on average get paid more. Of course, you can have skew and so forth. But that's the idea in English. And I would wager, if you're at all familiar with something like a SQL language or really any scripting type language, a lot of this you can in fact infer. And that's a nice aspect of XQuery, is that it is, to some extent, rather self-explanatory. It's certainly relatively readable, even though we are clearly outside the scope of what would be rigorous XML syntax at this point, unlike something like XSLT. What about conditional expressions? Well, this is quite the powerful language. Yeah. Sure. If a department doesn't have any employees, it would not be considered because count would not be greater than or equal to 10, so it would be ignored. Nope. Nope. It would just be ignored because it's not by definition a big department anyway. Okay. Good question. So this where statement is only allowing you to iterate over those departments whereby the number of employees in that department is greater than 10. When you proceed to compute the average salaries, both for ordering reasons and for salary reasons, you are considering all of the salaries of all of the employees in this department. Because what you're filtering on is, do we even want to consider this department at all? If yes, we consider the average of everyone's salaries. If there's fewer than 10 people in the department, though, we don't consider this department at all. We move on to the next iteration of the loop. So we're not filtering out. We're not considering only persons 11 through whatever. We're considering the whole department. The filter just says, do we include this department or not? So some conditional expressions. So here we have some case insensitivity, first of all. This was excerpted from a different source, which you can follow online if you want another tutorial of sorts. For hin document of library.xml/holding, well, what are we returning? Well, in this particular example, you are returning a node set of holding elements, such that the first child of these holding elements is going to be the title of the holding, the context here being some kind of library database. The second child, then, is going to be what? It's going to be what? Sorry? Well, what's the next child of holding going to be? The first child of a holding element is going to be a title node. The comma indicates the second child will next be either an editor or an author. So in short, if this current holding is a journal, the holding element's going to be holding with a child of title, with a second child of an editor. But if it's not a journal, you're going to get the holding element having a title and an author. So that's all. What we have in this expression, are what are called quantified expressions. So here we have an iteration over all elements called book in bib.xml. But we're going to be a little looser now with our where condition, saying where there exists some p in b/paragraph that satisfies the following. So this is sort of a way of mapping an evaluative expression onto a node set, whereby we're saying consider on this iteration this element b, which is a book, if there exists some p, let's call this a paragraph, some paragraph in that book that contains either the word sailing or, that contains the word sailing and contains the word windsurfing, in which case you should return this book's title. So translate that, if you would, into English for me. What question has someone just asked the librarian, the result of which is the librarian executed this computer on their 21st century card catalog? Perfect. This customer wants to know the titles of all books that are about sailing and windsurfing. So you get a bit more power now with this ability to say where there's some expression. Moreover, you can define on the fly a sort of variable, a placeholder like P, that allows you to subsequently, in the context of this where clause, to execute for additional queries. Down below, what is this query in answer to? What kind of desire?
Saying that every paragraph in the book has to contain the word sailing?
Perfect. Two for two. So this is a customer who just came up to the librarian and said, I would like to know the title of all of the books that are really about sailing. In fact, every darn paragraph in the book mentions sailing. Yeah.
For the rare stuff,
you could have an if, yes, you could approach this differently, whereby you have an if and maybe an else construct nested inside, which would achieve the same result. The difference here is that we're filtering, in a sense, at a higher level. We're only considering in the first place in our iteration those nodes that do satisfy that where clause. So it would be like you're simply filtering sooner. And which one is more efficient depends in part on the processor and where you're grabbing the data from. Because an expression like this might actually be, could arguably be more efficient if you're pulling an XML database that in which it's very expensive to return unnecessary data. In this case, you would get back a smaller node set to iterate over in the, anyway. Data types. So just so that you know, they exist, but again, we're borrowing from another language, which we will introduce in its nearer entirety, being XML schema. So you have a whole bunch of data types, which are relevant in that there are some data type specific functions, but you've seen that already in XPath, that there are certain functions like round that can only be applied to numbers, not really to strings. So the same applies here, but there are a huge number of data types that now exist in these newer languages, more so than exist, I would say, in most languages. So you'll see those, and we'll spend more time on those in the future. Last tidbit to introduce is just some other types of expressions that suggest some of the additional capabilities of XQuery. For instance, you can actually check typing by doing something like the instance of check here. You can determine that 5 embraced inside of an A element is an instance of XS integer, which is, again, something from XML schema that we'll come back to. There is the ability in XQuery to switch, as you can in many languages, on different types, for instance. So what you have here, and this will make more sense in the context of XML schema, what you have in the second bullet here is a switch on an element called billing address that's a child of some customer variable, and you have 4 different cases, the last of which is a default, and you're saying that if it is the case that that dollar sign A is an instance of a US address, that is, if it is of this type, US address, then go ahead and return the state. If the current address is of type Canada address, return the province. If the address is of type Japan address, return the prefecture. Otherwise, return the string unknown. And this syntax here of element paren star comma US address will come back to, in effect, what that expression is saying is the dollar sign A variable, which is going to be in billing address element, an element of any name, hence the star, comma of type US address or Canada address or Japan address. So again, we'll come back to this in XML schema, whereby in schema you will be able to define your own types, and with languages like XQuery, you will be able to act based on not the name of an element or the value of an element, but on the structure of an element, that is, the type of an element. And that's a useful thing indeed. Can be a useful thing indeed if you choose to use XML for these purposes. So let's go ahead and take a 5-minute break, and we will resume with DTD, which is fun, useful, and comes with a bunch of demos. We are back, and DTDs are on the menu. Notice that in our examples directory tonight, there's a couple files that have white space in their name. Ignore the stuff up top, but notice for now that we have this 3-element document, foo, bar, and baz. Notice that there is some white space in this document for pretty printing reasons, human readability, and so forth. And when we have in the past run our SACS parser code, I think we had SACS parser or SACS demo and SACS demo 2, recall that when we printed those sort of pseudocode SACS elements, things got rather messy and kind of ugly. Well, notice that if we run white space demo, which is very similar code to that SACS demo from long ago, on the file called significant white space, which is that same file, notice that we get these very ugly SACS events, right? We've seen this before. This is sort of messy, but the reason is that those character events include not only white spaces, but also what special characters? Backslash N, backslash R on a PC perhaps, backslash T, and so forth. But wouldn't you like, and haven't you long wanted perhaps, or at least wondered how you might do it, your output to instead be as such, ignore that white space? Well, finally tonight with DTD, do we have now the language with which to specify whether or not white space is significant? Recall that toward the end of Project 1, for some brownie points, you were challenged with dealing with white space in some way. Well, tonight we make more precise what it means to be ignorable and what it means to be significant white space. This, though, is our introduction to DTD. DTD was introduced to you in Project 3. In the context of what, moreover, news feeds look like. So this is the same fragment, the one up here, not the one you probably have in your printout, of what you see in Project 3 having as a representative news feed. So you can sort of infer, just by looking at this document, what the structure of these files are. But what we do in Project 3 is specify with what's called a DTD what the document should look like. And we specify more precisely what a moreover newsfeed document will look like. And this is useful if you are writing code, whether it's Java code using some inlined XPath expressions, whether you're writing XSLT, whether you're writing XQuery against some document. It is very useful, if not necessary, to know what the structure of that document is in advance if you want to be able to produce predictable results without having yourself, for instance, to deal with a whole bunch of error checking. Wouldn't it be nice if the XML parser validated your document for you, handed it off to you, maybe as a root of a DOM, or maybe a sequence of SACS events, but a sequence of SACS events or a DOM that you could trust is in some prescribed format? If nothing else, it allows you to take what we crossed our fingers with in Project 1, these leaps of faith that the document is going to look like what you expect. So with that said, this is a DTD for moreover news feeds. Notice that the taglines for each of these files have spoken to this notion of well-formedness and this notion now of validity. What does it mean for an XML document to be well-formed? It's got the right hierarchical structure. When you open something, you close it, and you do that in reverse order. What else? Quotes, attributes, values are quoted with either matching single or matching double quotes. What else? Yeah?
All the attributes on an element are unique.
All of the attributes are unique. That is a good question if that is imposed, though, as a constraint of well-formedness. I don't recall offhand if the parser should throw an error or if that behavior is actually undefined. I would have to check with respect to well-formedness. You have to have one and only one what? Root element. All right, so and there are a couple of other constraints you could toss in there, but validity speaks to something different. Validity assumes first, and before you can slap the validity sticker on a document, it's assumed that the document is well-formed. Otherwise, it doesn't parse, right? Your parser should throw an error. Validity is sort of a second tier of checking on some document, and the validity says, yes, not only is this document, to be valid, syntactically correct, i.e. well-formed, it too conforms to some document type definition. That is, it not only is structurally correct, syntactically correct, it also is structurally like some prescription that we expect it to be. It is in some prescribed format. So you can kind of infer, even from DTD, what a moreover document looks like. Clearly, inside of a moreover document, there is an element, in all caps there, called moreover news. And just for now, take a guess as to what it means in this top line in parentheses for it to say article star.
Well, in most
types of articles, no. Moreover, news elements, according to this definition, appear to have zero or more article children. and we'll expand upon the rest in just a moment. So when we've been using XHTML transitional, and I've said in one or more specifications, your code should be valid XHTML, but we're not going to check it. Well, what does it mean if you make a web page that is valid XHTML 1.0? What does that mean? Yeah, so an XHTML document is said to, a web page is said to be valid XHTML 1.0, transitional, if it adheres to some DTD, where a DTD is simply the specification by the W3C for what XHTML should look like. That is to say, even if you had in an XHTML, even if you had in a web page source code, a tag like this, is this tag well formed? Messy handwriting aside, is that well formed? Okay. Not that messy. All right. Yeah. All right. It's a little dark, too. There we go. So, yes, it's well formed. Why? Well, one, it has an open tag that is syntactically correct. There's then some text. Then there's a closed tag. But, moreover, this closed tag happens to line up perfectly in terms of case sensitivity, in terms of spelling, with the start tag. Ergo, this thing is, in fact, well-formed. If that same well-formed element appeared in a web page's source code, would that web page still be valid XHTML? Well, no, it's a very leading question. No, it wouldn't be, because Blink, and I always pick on this one because it's the most glaring example of what's been dropped from these web pages today, is not in the W3C's recommendation for XHTML 1.0. And thankfully, I don't think even IE or Netscape support it anymore, maybe. Maybe one of them does. But in any case, if you go via our resources page to the recommendation for XHTML, do a Control F and search for Blink, you will not find it. Do a Control F and search for H1, will you find it? Yes, you'll find H1. You'll find H2. You'll find H3. These are the heading elements that you can use in HTML and XHTML. This is only to say that in the DTDs that you can usually find in the appendices of the recommendations, you have a very precise definition of what XHTML or what HTML4 actually is. And it's in a syntax like what you saw a moment ago. So this is valid XHTML for the reason being, one, we include a doc type to be valid XHTML. For instance, you must specify what the DTD in use is. Otherwise, it's out of context. That's why we've long been pasting that sort of thing atop a lot of your XHTML output, whether dynamically generated in XSLT or just in some flat file demos. This is valid XHTML itself. The requisite tags to be valid in XHTML, for the curious, are that you must have an HTML element, you must have a head element, you must have a title element, and you must have a body element. But those are the only elements you must have in a document to be valid. They don't even need to have data, but they must be there to be valid. It is not our focus in this course to have you writing perfectly valid HTML. Our expectation is certainly that you write well-formed HTML and XSLT, because otherwise your output won't even output. But realize that to be valid, what it means is that it adheres to some set of rules. So what is DTD? DTD, document type definition. You've seen it before. Anytime you've looked at a web page's source code or generated one yourself, you have been making mention of DTDs. The DTD reference here being rather explicit. What this says is that essentially this document should be validated against what is defined here as a DTD with that particular path. .DTD is typically the file extension used. So let's generalize it here. DTD is actually in the XML specification itself. This is why it is germane to XHTML, because XHTML is just XML-compliant HTML, in effect. It is perhaps the only part of the XML recommendation that itself is not written in XML. XQuery aside, every other language we've looked at Well, even that's a white lie, because XPath, not really XML. It goes between quotes, usually. XSLT, significantly XML-based. XML schema, significantly XML-based. A lot of the other XML-related languages that we'll look at briefly later in the course, all entirely XML-based. And yet, in the DTD definition, in the DTD's definition, in the XML spec, not in XML. Which is sort of a nuisance, because it means when writing a parser for XML that's quote-unquote validating, that is, your parser checks not only for well-formedness but also for validity, you can't parse the document's definition using the same parser. It, in effect, means you write two parsers in order to write a validating parser, which is, in some sense, just silly, because it means writing redundant code. This is why we don't even bother including a validation component to Project 1, because it's just another parser altogether to write. Kind of looks like XML, kind of looks like processing instructions, but not really, because we're talking about exclamation points and sort of regular expression-like syntax. It's sort of all over the place. Certainly not consistent with XML, but it is quick and relatively easy to write. In fact, though XML schema, you will see in a couple of weeks' time... Oh, let's take a five-minute break. Excuse me. Lou. Yes, where are you? All right, we're back from dinner, and we're still on DTD. So let's get to the fun examples, but move past some of this background material. DTDs are an alternative to another mechanism, which you can use to similarly validate data, that other alternative being XML schema. And we'll actually spend a couple of lectures on it, given the expressiveness of it, but also given the fact that, unlike most of the recs we've looked at so far, schema is broken up into not one, not two, but three different full-fledged recommendations. So there's a lot to it, and we will pluck off as much of it as we can. DTD, I would say, is sort of quicker, dirtier, easier, but less expressive. You cannot do certain things with DTD that you might very reasonably want to do. Dare say DTDs remain more popular than schema, if only because they are quicker, easier, dirtier, and can sometimes just get the job done more than sufficiently. With that said, DTDs tend to encapsulate what a document should look like. So if you are, for instance, trying to implement a documentation standard, that is to say, you want to produce some user manual for your company's product or some other type of documentation that you want to standardize with some kind of metadata, tagging things like chapters and titles and subtitles and FAQs and so forth, well, tagging that with XML is probably pretty reasonable these days, especially if you want to spit it out in different formats, maybe an online format, maybe a printed PDF format, maybe in different environments like a PDA. That's quite a good use of XML, I would say. But why come up with your own specification for something like a user's manual when you can use off-the-shelf DTDs? DocBook, for instance, is one such example, which essentially is an XML specification for what documentation should or could look like. Moreover, by leveraging an off-the-shelf standard, you get interoperability. If someone else has implemented software that somehow reads the DocBook standard and can churn out user manuals based on it, you get that for free then. You don't need to actually reinvent that wheel yourself. Financial exchange. OFX is an XML-based data format for the exchange of finance-related information, prices, sales, and so forth. Why come up with your own if you can use not only an off-the-shelf specification, but also perhaps off-the-shelf tools or software that already supports that particular file format? Voice XML, yet another example, and you can look at the specification there of a standard for actually encapsulating voice data within XML, so for better or for worse. So to DTD or not to DTD, it depends on the application. So thus far, we really haven't bothered with DTDs, and that's in part because a lot of what we've done hasn't really warranted it. For instance, a lot of the XML you've been churning out is of your own design, which is to say, unless you completely distrust your own abilities, you probably don't need to validate the data you yourself are outputting. For instance, users.xml in Wahoo. There's really no reason for us to be validating that document to ensure that it contains a user element followed by a news categories element if we're the ones that are outputting it in the first place. But as soon as you start hooking into others' data feeds, like Wahoo is worth Moreover, like you might with some RSS feed, like iTunes does with our podcast feed, you really want to trust that the input data is going to be in some prescribed format. So you can write code against your assumptions and not every time you get a new feed from someone have to write code that error checks it yourself. It's a pain, if nothing else, to do that. Moreover, sometimes you want to standardize on what the metadata is. So I say price, you say cost. Suppose you're in sharing information with some partner of some sort. Well, in their file, they tend to call things price. Well, you tend to call things cost. Well, when you at least have a specification of what the documents look like, you can much more easily or much more correctly convert one to the other when you at least standardize on the types of elements that you are actually using. So let's consider this, a song element, which is just a bunch of marked up XML for a Dave Matthews song. You can take a look at this in two different versions on the course's website, and you have copies in your printouts tonight. So here's a song element. It is not hard for you, just a human being, a developer, to describe in words what a song element should look like using this as an example from which to infer the structure of the document, right? If you were to describe for me a song element, and I'll cut you off because it very quickly becomes a boring story. What does a song element look like? Touche. Touche, that. So it's an element called song. It's got a child called titled. It's got a value, which is a text child. After the title element, there's a composer, and so forth. Would you think, though, it would be unreasonable to reorder these elements? Would it still be a song element if called by any other name? Would it still be a song element if you had composer followed by title? Right, sure, but these are the starts of issues that you start to have to at least think about when writing code, perhaps, that parses content like this, or when it's shared, or when you want to output the content in the first place, it might be useful to bear in mind what the format should be. So let's try to formalize what this content actually looks like. Here is a DTD for that particular song element. Notice that in the ordering of these open bracket exclamation point elements do not themselves have to appear in precisely this order. I've simply, for clarity's sake, repeated them in the same order, but it would be just as correct to reorder these entirely. In fact, the root element, the song element, doesn't even need to be the first one mentioned in the DTD. I say this is a DTD. DTDs, as we'll see, can appear in two places. This one appears in a file called song.dtd, which is not uncommon. The XHTML DTD similarly exists somewhere in a file, or you could embed it if you wanted in your own web page, but that would be strange. So let's read what this says. The element called song has what as children? A title? A composer? One or more composers. How many producers? Zero or more. Zero or more publishers. Might have a length, might not have a length. So question mark in regular expression speak means zero or one instance. So it has a year or it doesn't have a year, but it's not going to have two. And it has one or more artists. Moreover, it has those children in that order. Moreover, with that capitalization. So XML is case sensitive. So similarly with the DTD, be case sensitive. So what does it mean to be a title element? Well, title element's pretty darn simple. It is just parsed character data. So it's just a text node beneath it, essentially. So we parenthesize around PC data, but that just means it has text content. What about a composer, a producer, a publisher, a length, artist, year? Same. So already, this makes sense because we are capturing the structure of the foregoing example, the song element, but we're really not taking it as far as you might think you could or might want to. For instance, there's absolutely no typing here, even though length could arguably be a numeric field, the number of seconds in the song, as just a large integer. The year could certainly be just an integer, a non-negative integer. But as such, this DTD, if applied to an XML document, is only going to guarantee you what, in effect? The order, and that those elements exist in a certain location, if they're there at all, but it doesn't tell you anything about the structure of the data, which is to say that even with this DTD, if you can trust that your XML parser, which maybe is being used way underneath the hood in your servlet container, and it's passing you this XML file as a sequence of SACS events or a DOM or maybe an XPath sort of type API, Well, you can't assume in, say, your higher level Java code that if you grab the value of a year, that you can add to it 2,000, maybe if we're using two-digit years, because what if it's a string? What if it's junk value? It's there, but it's complete junk. You could start getting in your own Java code casting errors, which means now you need to try everything and catch any errors that might happen. And sure, you're really not going the whole nine yards. You're imposing some kind of validity checking, but there's no capacity here really to enforce any kind of data typing, which just means for you, the developer, more work. But it was much less work writing the DTD, as you'll see, than it might be with something like XML schema. So let's tease these things apart. If you have an element declaration, as they're called, it looks generally like that, where I've inserted some arbitrary but not incorrect additional white space just to make things clear. You specify bang element, followed by the element's name, and then in parentheses, usually, the content model. You've heard that catchphrase before. Back in lecture 2, we talked about four content models. Well, they're about to come back to perhaps haunt you. So the content models for the declarations can be as follows. First of all, the elements that you define in a DTD, the names must be unique. You can't redefine in the same DTD what an element is. If you have a content model specified, it will be one of these five entities. It will be either PC data, which we've seen. So what does this say a title should be? Parsed character data. That is to say, title cannot have any children. So there is some constraint in that sense, but if it has characters under there, they could be numbers, they could be punctuation marks, they could be nothing, but it's not going to be having any child elements. If it's empty, that is to say, if you specify that the course element in lowercase has an empty content model, well, what does that mean using our nomenclature from lecture 2? It's simultaneously opened and closed. It has no children, but it might have attributes, and we'll get to attributes in a moment. It might have elements as a content model. We'll come back to that in a second. It might have mixed content. We'll come back to that in a second. It might have any content, which just means it can have PC data, it can have children, it can have nothing, whatever is fine. Element content, so zooming in on that fourth or third or fourth bullet. An element content looks like what we really saw on the song DTD already. So the top bullet there in the example defines an element called song, and a song has a title, and one or more composers, zero or more producers, and so forth. Well, what about a spec? What does a spec element have? I'm sorry?
Front body and maybe back.
Front body and maybe back. Children in that order with that capitalization. How about a div1 element? Has a head child? Followed by zero or more P or list or note elements, followed by zero or more div2 elements. Okay? Sorry? Okay. So sort of contrived examples, but still pretty readable. But again, not such a powerful language that we can specify real constraints on the actual data. Really, we can impose structure on the document, not values. Here is just a summarization for those less familiar with regular expression syntax, exactly what these various pieces of syntax mean, but we've pretty much teased those apart verbally. What do we mean by mixed content? Well, if you have mixed content, recall, that means that you can have both parsed character data and or child elements. If you want to specify a mixed content model, it's literally like this. You don't write quote-unquote mixed or anything. You literally write in the parentheses for your content model PC data, which if present must be there first. Sort of annoying, but fact of the matter, constraint, followed by the elements that may or may not be there. So what are we defining a P element as containing here in the first example? Can contain nothing, sure, because it's a star around that whole content model, which means zero or more of those things. But in English, a paragraph element, this is kind of a simplified definition of the P element from XHTML, can contain what? So text, as implied by PC data, or some of that text itself might be marked up with anchor elements, underline elements, bold elements, italicized elements, emphasized elements. So in short, in this indented bullet, here's an example of a P element that does in fact conform to that DTD. And mixed content might in the past have seemed like a strange content model. Why would you mix both text and elements? Well, certainly in a markup language like HTML or XHTML, perfectly reasonable to intermingle the two. If you were to have, though, to be clear, mixed content, PC data must, just for definitional reasons, appear first in what's probably an ORD expression, as you see here. So we have a definition here of a PO element. A PO element, similarly, can have zero or more instances of text, item elements, ship date elements, or quantity elements. And there below is a sample purchase order for a Floby, if you're familiar with the product. Yeah?
But in DTP, there is, for instance, no way of specifying that A or U or B has to be enclosed in angle brackets.
A or U or B has to be enclosed in angle brackets, yes. This is saying not a literal A or a literal U or a literal B. This is saying that a P element can have as children A elements, B elements, U elements, which means by definition they will be flanked with those angle brackets. We're not talking about literal data. We're talking about elements when we say A, B, I, E, M here. Attributes. So how do you, first, I'm going quickly, but just because we had some dinner and some time constraints now. So attributes. Any questions before we proceed? All right, so how do we add attributes to the mix? The syntax here is even crazier because really you keep saying only by way of white space, which by convention I've written as such with new lines and so forth. But here's how you define a list of one or more attributes for an element. You specify bang at list and then the element name for which you are defining a set of attributes. Then after some white space, a new line in this case, you specify an attribute's name, its type, and its default declaration, each of which will explode in a moment. And you can have one or more of those if you're to have them at all. Well, what do we mean? Let's do it by example. Here on the top is an example of an attribute called, or rather, an attribute list for an element called term def. So some definition for some term, let's say. It looks like a term def element can have how many attributes? Three, an ID, a type, and a name attribute. What do we mean by that? Well, an ID attribute is of type ID. And we've glossed over this detail for a while, but there are, in fact, some forms of data types in XML, like NM token and NM tokens and ID tokens and so forth. They really aren't a necessary thing to follow in order to make use of this, but essentially, suffice it for now to say, and we'll come back to this with XML schema, there is an ID data type that specifies what an ID should look like. And we'll come back to this in a second. But in short, the ID attribute, its value must be of type ID, and it's required. So its default declaration, as we saw in the previous slide, is required. That means ID must be present. Otherwise, the document's not valid. Type is just character data. It must be there. It must be present. Name is of character data, but it is implied, which essentially means it is optional. Doesn't need to be there. Okay, what about an element called list? Well, how many attributes does a list element take, according to our second example here? Sorry? Well, not one or three. At most one. So it's tough to parse visually without having seen examples like this before, but an attribute, a list element can have, if any at all, an attribute called type. That type attribute can only take on one of three literal values, quote-unquote bullets, quote-unquote ordered, quote-unquote glossary, which do not get written in quotes, but I'm describing as quotes with quotes because they are literal values, even though that is the correct syntax. If, however, a list element does not have a type attribute in the input document, guess what your XML parser is going to do for you for free before handing you that sax event or that DOM node? It's going to add a type attribute and assign it the default value of ordered. So sort of a useful thing, because even if the user who gave you this document or the feed from which it's coming doesn't contain this attribute, you can at least trust that by the time it reaches your Java code or whatever language, it will be there, because DTDs can in effect insert missing content into a document. What about a form element? A form element can have what type of attribute? An attribute that's character data, an attribute called method, and it turns out that it's fixed, which is to say that a form element must have, in this example, an value of post in all caps. And this is misleading as such. It should actually, it's better described, even though this is just an example, as lowercase. Because XHTML, for instance, if you have a form element and you specify the method has got to be post, lowercase, get, lowercase, or there are some other options that we've not focused on. But that implies that it must be fixed at this value. And if not, if someone gives you an XML document that has a form element with a method attribute that's foo, it will be invalid, and it will not even reach your Java code, because the parser will say invalid. And we'll see what we mean by the parser quitting on you like that. Finally, a paper element has a language attribute of type character data that is, this is, its default value is, I'm trying to remember myself how to parse this last one. No constraints on it. That's what it is. There are no constraints on what the value of this language attribute can be, but if it's not there, it will get a default value of English. So this is sort of an extension of the idea in bullet number 2, but you're not even imposing a list of possibilities. You're saying it can be anything, but if it's not even there, let's put English in its place. Yeah?
On the fixed one, that's a constant, but it means that when you're passing the XML, it has to have post as the attribute.
Correct.
So if you have anything but possibility exception?
Correct. If you try in example 3 to have a form element in your input document with a method attribute with a value anything other than quote-unquote post, it will be invalid. And the parser will reject the document, and your Java code that might have requested, hey, go parse this document for me, return a DOM node, it won't even get that far. It'll throw an exception most likely. No. If you leave the attribute's value empty, that violates the definition of the DTD because it is not post, so it would similarly be invalid. So in short, if it is not quote-unquote post, it is invalid.
Because like everything else, you can have the default value. Can you have
a
default value for a constant?
A default value for if it's a constant, it can only be one value. I'm having trouble imagining the context here that we're...
If you have a fixed attribute, you have to pass the value. It can't be like
yes.
A list where you can not put it in or put it in or a language where if you don't put it in, you'll put it in English.
No, correct. If you specify that it's fixed, it must be fixed at that value, and this is simply a way of imposing a constraint on your document that if this attribute is present, it will be this value when you know it. In these other approaches, for instance, 4 and 2, can you actually specify some default values if it's not even there? But as such, they're mutually exclusive approaches. Here are the attribute types. And again, we'll spend more time on this in schema. But there are a bunch of different types for attributes. They essentially define it. They're essentially defined here as excerpted from the recommendation for XML. The only one that I passed a little commentary on is the second one. It would be nice to think that the ID attribute, that is to say, if you have an attribute of type ID, it would be nice if it could be strictly numeric. After all, when we talk about keys and databases and so forth, 9 times out of 10, arguably, it's an int or an unsigned int. It is not, as the ID type requires, a string that starts with a letter. This is why I think in project 1 or project 2 with my blockbuster.xml, if I'm recalling my own document correctly, all of the IDs were not strictly numbers, but they started with 1 or 2 letters. Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe when we had those actor ref and the actor IDs, they were not strictly numeric. And that was to be consistent with this notion, even though we didn't use DTDs back then, the notion of a unique ID actually starting with a letter. Sort of a stupid reality. But realize we're going to toss it up there and come back to that with XML schema, since for the most part it's not so necessary. Here's just a summary of what those default declarations meant. Fixed means it's got to be there. Required means it's got to be there, but we're not so interested in what the value is. Implied means it's optional. Can be there, doesn't have to be there. Okay, so where do DTDs go? In short, That's the syntax, and you've pretty much seen examples representative of pretty much everything you could do with them. So how do you incorporate them? I keep saying, well, your parser can reject a document if it's invalid. Well, how does a parser know what DTD to validate an XML document against? Well, there's two approaches. You can have what's called an external subset for the DTD or an internal subset. The latter means that you can embed inside of an XML document itself the DTD at the top of the file, along with any PIs you have up there, with your XML declaration up there, and so forth. Or you can have it in an external file, aka external subset. So here is an example. If you wanted to have it inside of a file, you literally put at the top of your XML file constructs like the first example, open bracket, bang, doc type, and then the element that is the root element of the document. So song is assumed to be our root element here, followed by a square bracket, followed by the DTD. So we've been looking at examples of DTDs, at-list definitions, at-list declarations, element declarations. All of those can be pasted in between those square brackets at the top of an XML file. Or you can simply use a tag like this atop your XML file. You can say that the root element of the file, or rather, the element in this file against which a DTD should be applied is an element called song. What file should you use? Well, it's a file called song.dtd on the local system. Or you can go one step further and you can say, you know what, use the DTD called song.dtd on the local file system, but further extend those definitions as follows. Yeah. You can. You can, in fact, override definitions by doing it in this way. So it's similar in spirit to the import process that we saw in XSLT2. In XSLT, yeah?
Does the element name following doctype have to be the root?
Does the element name that follows bang doctype have to be the root element? You always see it this way, but again, I don't want to commit yet until I look at the spec itself. It might not necessarily be the case. You might be able to apply different ones different places, but let me not commit to that until I've looked more carefully at the spec, since that is the uncommon case. So I'll hedge and get back to you. So let's see an example of this. So in our examples directory, we saw earlier song1.xml. This is an example of clearly an XML file that uses an internal subset for its DTD. So the syntax is the same as we saw a moment ago, and then we've just pasted the DTD that we saw right after break. So is this XML document valid with respect to that DTD? Yeah, so how can we see this? Well, we do have included in tonight's examples a SAX validator program, which quite simply is going to, using SAX, parse the document, and then it's going to print out the standard output an error message if the document's not valid. That's how it'll work for us. So I am going to run this on the XML file called song1.xml. Enter. Okay, nothing happened, which is good. Let's now break it for demonstration purposes. Tell me what line I can delete from the XML that will render this document invalid. Okay, I heard year. Correct? Oh, I see some head shaking. That is not going to render invalid. The reason being, maybe it's somewhat of a reasonable mistake to make, since the question mark for year is over there. But that means it doesn't have to be there. So what could we remove? Title. I heard title the loudest. So I'm going to get rid of title, save it, rerun my little program. And now what you see is a parsing error at line 22, column 8. The content of element type song must match this particular content model. Not a terribly instructive message, but probably more important for you, the developer, is just that this is not valid. And therefore, you don't want to make any assumptions about it. Well, how does SAX validator work? How do you actually turn on validation? Because thus far, you've not been using validation. And in fact, if you just toss a DTD in your XML files henceforth, they too will be ignored by the SAX parser or the DOM builder unless you turn on validation. And that's what you have in SAX validator is a representative approach with JAXP to turning on validation. Turns out, it's a one-liner. Simply, when you instantiate your factory, before you churn out your SAX parser, turn on the validating flag. And that means the parser that you churn out will, in fact, look for a DTD and use it if present. And the rest of this, notice that this little demo, as always, is just an extension of default handler. Right? That should be old news by now. But if you looked at the Java docs closely, you'll know that default handler not only implements content handler, it also implements an interface called error handler. And now that error handler interface is relevant to us. The error handler interface, if you look at the Java doc, defines signatures for three methods: error, warning, and fatal error, which if you read the XML specification carefully, it will tell you what kinds of mistakes in a document are errors, but you can still keep going, what kinds of mistakes are warnings, but you can still keep going, and what kinds of mistakes are fatal errors. You cannot keep going. Think of this as like a lot of compilers, GCC, Visual Studio. They give you different types of error messages or warnings, some of which screw up your compilation, some of which just annoy you with warning messages, but you can still build your executable. Same idea. Invalidity is a fatal error. So what is happening in my little demo program is when the SAX parser, which has had its validating flag turned on, so it's going to try to validate, by definition, a SAX parser will call the fatal error method that it implements by way of the error handler interface. And so what I've simply done is overridden the default handler's default implementation, which is just open squiggly, close squiggly, with this somewhat more helpful error message for demonstration purposes. So in short, this is why earlier when I was telling the tale of your Java code never actually seeing the XML input document, if you try to parse an invalid XML document, it's because the parser is throwing a fatal error, which prior to that document ever getting to your application by way of SAX events or by way of a DOM node being returned, the parser stops it in its tracks and just aborts at that point. And so you might not get back the entirety of your structure, and so your application would therefore try to catch whatever SAX exception gets thrown as based on the interface. So the relevant code, so far as JAXP goes, is the SAX parser factory, because you can just turn on its validation flag, and then that error handler interface, which I'll invite you to take a look at the Java doc for if you'd like to see the signatures, but it is as simple as implementing those others. So now we'll conclude pretty much with this white space issue that we promised earlier. So in ignorable in significant whitespace.xml, notice that we have that same example as before, foo, bar, and baz. But notice via internal subset, I've defined that the root element, foo, is going to have a definition of a foo element whose content model is any. That means whatever can appear as a child of foo. But bar and baz must be empty elements. Okay? And notice, to be clear, foo can be anything. Bar and baz must be empty. If foo can be anything, what types of children can it have? That's the catch. It can have mixed content, because if there are no constraints imposed, it can be anything. What that means is, you know what? A child of foo could be backslash n, could be backslash t, could be bar, could be baz, but could be any number of PC data characters. So this is why when we run our whitespace demo, which is pretty much just a rehashed version of SAX demo from earlier lectures, when we run this on significant whitespace, notice that that white space is significant because foo was defined as having any type of children. White space is any of any type, and so it's included in the SAX events. If, by contrast, in ignorable whitespace.xml, we redefine the DTD as follows, why is it the case that all this pretty printed white space in the XML is now, by nature, ignorable? Foo is not allowed to have PC data, which, in the case of whitespace, handled it a little differently than, like, ABC. If you have whitespace as children of foo, they are ignored if the content model says that foo can only have elements bar and baz. If you tried to put the characters ABC after foo, well, that's not allowable. Right? White space is treated somewhat differently from ABCs and 1-2-3s because it's useful for human readability. So when we parse this thing with ignorable white space, notice that the SACS events do not include the white space because the parser has been informed via the DTD that, yeah, you might see white space, but it's not in the content model. As such, just ignore it. Yeah?
Maybe this is a little strange because you want to write the DTD that would error out on white space. And how would you do that?
If you wanted to have a DTD where white space was not allowed, that would be difficult, if not impossible. I'll think on that as my own sort of challenge problem, but my gut reaction is that it's actually impossible with DTD, because the best you could do is specify that foo could not have any children at all, but that would be a heavy-handed solution, certainly. So there are constructs realized similar in syntax to the stuff we've looked at tonight, this element declaration and the doc type declaration and the atlas declaration, things like entities, which you've seen briefly. We talked about declaring an entity for NBSP so that it actually exists because you don't get it for free, even though Stylus likes to give it to you for free. There's issues of notation so that you can include essentially binary data, in a sense, into your document. I put it up there only because it doesn't fit nicely into any of the other categories we've looked at thus far, so just realize that there are similar constructs if you skim through the recommendation. But there are certainly shortcomings when it comes to this language. Relatively easy and powerful, though it may be, it's not well-formed XML, which probably is not so relevant to the typical developer, but certainly to those implementing the parsers that other people use. No built-in data types, real data types, beyond the ones we put on the board there, ints and strings and so forth, won't be offered to us until schema. Custom data types, you can't define your own data types like a US address, a Japan address, a Canada address. So that, too, will be coming in the future with schema. Ranges, you can't impose constraints on the data itself. You can't say that I need to guarantee that the year element will be between 1900 and 2000 for whatever reasons. You can just know that it's going to be PC data, in fact. It's not even namespace aware, which is a huge issue unto itself, because the more commonly namespaces are and the more constraints you want to impose on a document that uses namespaces and prefixes, it really is not an elegant solution using something like DTD. And unfortunately, and this is sort of a fun example, ordering must be imposed if you specify an element-only content model, for instance. It would be very reasonable, as I think we posited earlier, that a song element's children could reasonably appear in any order, right? Who cares if the title element comes last? I, as the developer, care that it comes at all with the input. But you cannot, with DTD, do something like this. You cannot say that an element called foo must have three children, bar, baz, and quux, but they can come in any order. In other words, this syntax, though I've written it there, is invalid DTD. You cannot do it, which is perhaps just as well, because notice this is just for three children. If you were to permute the eight or so children that a song element had, I mean, it would be a nightmare just enumerating it. And so this limitation alone is a relatively significant one in that you, if you impose a constraint that elements must be there, you must specify their order. And any deviation from that in the input document would be invalid, which is perhaps too draconian sometimes for some applications. So next week is spring break, which means there's no lecture or such. The week after, I will actually be traveling, so we will have a guest lecturer who is actually a very engaging gentleman, who is this mysterious Blake Mike, who's been writing all of your previous year's handouts from section notes. He's a former student and former teaching fellow. He will introduce XML schema. I can't promise that he will bring pizza with him, so I know I'm already setting him up for failure in that regard, but that's all right. And then when I return the week after, we will continue with XML schema and with Project 4 as well. So have a great spring break, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.